Speaker Eric Harris Brown presented this talk during the E.F. Schumacher Society's training seminar, Building Sustainable Local Economies, held on May 21st to the 25th of 2008. The E.F. Schumacher Society is a membership-supported organization. For more information on the E.F. Schumacher Society, visit www.smallisbeautiful.org, call 413-528-1737, or write to 140 Jug End Road, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, 01230.
Programmer, and a sort of engineering kind of person, that is a deep passion of mine. I really care about that. And we need to understand what this means. What is a system? So now we're getting into meaning. The economic system, what kind of system is our economic system? It's a weird thing because it's not like a bicycle, which is a system. It contains all kinds of parts, right? And the bicycle works or it doesn't work. Our economic system is more like geometry, where it's a constructed system. Does this make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, let's take an example of the ecosystem. The ecosystem is out there. It is run by physical stuff. The sun heats the water, which goes up and makes rain, which falls on the plants and they grow. And the system is pulled together by physics. It works because physics works. Our economic system is different from that. It reflects reality. It reflects true things. Land, labor, capital, right? People talk about all this stuff. But it's also constructed. It's something that we've made up ourselves. And that's like geometry. Geometry is a constructed system. It's a set of rules that say, okay, if you draw lines here that are parallel, and you have a triangle, and all this other stuff, it describes reality that's out there, but it's constructed. We invented it. I'll show you a little picture here. That might help. Oh, it's hard to see. Okay, so it's a picture of a triangle, and it shows the degrees, right? If you have a triangle, 90 degrees of one side plus 40 plus 50 always adds up to 180 degrees. That's a rule of geometry. A triangle, the degrees of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees. Except when the triangle is on a sphere. In which case, it's 90 degrees because this line is parallel to that line, and then it goes up and it meets up here. What's going on here? There's a constructed system, one that describes reality that works on a plane, doesn't work when it's on a sphere. And our economic system is exactly the same thing. We have an economic system that has basic propositions that work when we're non-global as a nation. They don't work. Well, I mean, you can argue whether they work or don't work, but they certainly don't destroy the planet when we're not at the scale that we're at. Now, so the piece that I'm getting at with this, in terms of a constructed system, is that all of these systems are based on fundamental principles that are not part of the system, that are not developed from it. They are your initial assumptions, your axiom, word up there, axiom. And in the case of geometry, what you have is this axiom. And if you remember from the geometry, one of the axioms is that parallel lines never meet. And that works on a plane. But parallel lines always meet. If you switch your axiom, then you can start describing truths, reality, on a sphere. So what happened to me in this phase right here, was that I realized that there were some initial assumptions that were not real. They were constructed. They were axioms. They were principles that I had just taken fully for granted. So what are the axioms, the fundamental underlying principles, the things that we say are true without proof that they're true about economics? People want to give me some axioms of the economic system?
What'd you say?
Self-made man.
Self-correcting market.
Yeah, that's definitely one, right?
More markets.
Resources will never give out.
Resources
are
unlimited.
Technology never makes mistakes.
You know, this one is really interesting because from the point of view of Adam Smith, this really was true. It was like a good axiom.
Yeah.
It made sense to do that. And it meant that you could create wealth really, really fast. Increase people's well-being incredibly quickly. Mm-hmm. Just as a side point, but it's not true now. More axioms.
More is more. The invisible hand. Universal opulence.
More. Invisible hand.
Rational.
Rational
self-interest.
Okay. What was that? Rational. Any other axioms of our economic system?
Accounting.
Interesting. How is that an axiom?
Well, we have an idea that if we add up all the benefits and all the costs, we figure out the profit, but it's wrong because we don't add up all the benefits.
Oh, okay, so benefit,
cost
analysis,
in quantifiable terms.
Right, it can be exhaustively represented.
Okay. Any other actions?
Growth is based on consumption.
Well, growth is good.
Growth is good. Growth is good. Growth is necessary.
So I think these are interesting.
Civilization.
Efficiency. Okay.
What's civilized?
Excuse me?
More civilized.
Civilized.
Progress.
Civilized. Yeah. The word civilized comes from being from city. You are civilized if you live in a city.
Right.
That's to me is a really interesting one, but that's a whole other topic.
It seems like, and this isn't really an axiom, but it seems like the system is basically based on a mechanistic model, that it's only based on kind of input-output, and that everything is can be managed with commodity. That's kind of the nature of the economic organism. It's kind of like the touch of Midas. Everything is turned into
commodity. Commodifiability.
Yeah.
Commodification.
All right, so these are great. I want to tell you which were the axioms that I was blown out of the water by. That's what I'm going to share with you today. The axioms that I thought that I had, that I knew what they were, and that were completely different. And the first one we've already begun talking about, which is what is wealth. I don't think you can build an economic system until you have decided what wealth is.
Power.
Great, this is what our next thing is for here.
More.
Okay, what is wealth? Tell me what wealth is.
I heard
power.
Based on the system or based on your perspective? Mm-hmm.
Based on the system.
Knowledge, truth.
Okay, what I'd like now is, we're actually going to,
values.
We know what, just real quickly, what does our current system define as wealth?
And, okay. Well,
lots of money and assets.
Yeah.
Money and assets.
That doesn't come by income.
So you even started with money.
Power
money.
The power to have.
Okay, privilege. But you don't need to worry about what they think right now. What do we think? What do we know wealth is? What is wealth?
Power.
Okay. Power.
Capital.
Well-being. Thank you. That's very good. And more.
Freedom.
Yeah, freedom.
Freedom.
Health.
What?
Health.
Health. This marker is not wealthy. More.
Choices.
Protection.
Security, perhaps. Community. Mm-hmm. Caring or love.
Caring.
Excessive.
What?
Excessive
as well.
Access to capital.
That's an interesting one.
What's capital?
It's a brainstorm. More?
What we have.
What we have. Okay, can I put down the word stuff?
No.
Okay,
no.
What we have. Excellent. It's okay, it's a brainstorm, sorry. More, come on, guys. What
stuff?
Yeah.
Who thought of that?
But you didn't write it down.
Culture.
Culture. Oh, I love this one. Thank you.
Language.
Progress.
Food.
Mm. glad we have some stuff up here.
Good food.
Tools of the trade.
Shelter. So I think this is good enough. Do you all want to help me categorize these? Can we break these into groups? Okay, what are the group? What's the proper grouping for these things?
Necessities. Survival. The necessities, I guess. Resources.
Okay.
Well, I guess they could all be necessities.
Yeah. So, that's an interesting point. What's necessary? I'm not going to use that one because that doesn't break it into different things. Depends on who you are.
Want or need?
What?
Want or need?
For somebody, this is a need. For somebody, this is a want.
Right.
Commodity, relationship, and potential.
Ooh. Okay, let's see. Commodities, relationships, potential. I love that one. That's a good categorization of different things.
Okay, any of them? The material and non-material.
Okay, that breaks it into two great, material and non-material. I mean, you added a third part, because commodities would be the material, the relationships is something in between, and then potential is at a higher level.
The commodities are goods and services produced for market. So, there's all the non-market products. Mm-hmm. We have all the products.
Okay. Any other categorization schemes for this? What I'm trying to do here is build meaning. Remember, we're in the meaning section here. Because this is what happened to me. I came through this place of not knowing what wealth was and having meaning being built. So I'm trying to do that right now. And meaning is built by understanding individual things and how they fit together. In my experience, there's other kinds of meaning too. But so, another categorization scheme?
Well, it's funny. I just popped in my head, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as three categories.
Closely related to that one. That was interesting. Right. Yeah, pursuit of happiness is potential, liberty is the relationships between us, life being the commodities or the material goods. Okay, so, any other ones come to mind? Any other categorization schemes for this?
Mind and body.
Yep. That's exactly right. Material and non-material. Mind and body was that's beautiful. I mean,
I was thinking tangible and intangible.
Tangible and intangible. Okay, I'm going to give you what? Commons. Private. How does that work here? So
start to take a lot of stuff that's been privatized to really analyze it.
Freedom? How does that fit into your categorization scheme?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's like you have to ask that. Is freedom become individualized and only possible for some people, or is it kind of a commons?
It's because Jackson and Jason's categories fit with this so perfectly. Steiner's vision of it is threefold: is economic, political, and cultural. And basic necessities is what the economic realm generates. Political relationships, freedom, all these things is what takes place in the political realm. And then spiritual pursuits, education, all these things is a different form of wealth, and that takes place in kind of the cultural realm, the cultural spiritual realm. So it's good.
Okay.
Theory and personal reality.
Actually, you know, I should write these down. This is really bad. Okay, real quick, we have theory, personal reality. We have tangible, intangible. Maybe this isn't worth it because you probably can't even read what I'm writing. There was material. The other one was
relationships,
and the last one was
potential.
Potential. And then, how did you say it, Seth?
He said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So economics,
political, and
politics,
culture.
Anyway.
They're saying they're close, but if I was going to say life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, I mean they're very close. Three things are very close to each other, but they're also just very subtly different,
yeah.
Which is, I think. Okay.
But that also depends on the personal definition of each of those.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to give you guys a completely different categorization scheme. That's related, but it's different. Alright. I'm going to say that one category of those items is what is tradable wealth. Food, stuff, resources, time is tradable. That's the stuff we're most used to thinking about as well. But of course, you all pick all this other stuff as well. That's non-tradable. The second layer of wealth is what's measurable, but it's not tradable. Health, diversity, education, attention, strength, vitality, productive capacity. There's a number of these things here. Health came up. These are things that we value deeply and we consider to be our wealth, but we can't trade them. We can build them. We can build our health, build our education, build our diversity, build our capacity for attention, build our productive capacity, but you can't trade it away. And then what I would call the last level of wealth is that which is only acknowledgeable. It's not measurable. It's only acknowledgeable. And that is stuff like caring and love that was in your group, in your examples of wealth. Friendship, love, beauty, freedom, civility, and culture. You can acknowledge it, but you can't really measure it. Now, the reason why, well, not the reason why. There's something very interesting that comes out when you use this categorization scheme. And as a categorization scheme, it's just one of them. Your other ones are just as good. But the thing that seems to be particularly powerful about this categorization scheme is back to systemics. Who is a systemics person? Is that you? Okay. Systemically, if you think about systems, and you think about the systemics of wealth. Now, remember we were talking about an economic system and a constructed system? Well, we better be getting our definition of wealth from the point of view of an economic system, a whole rubric, a framework, a machinery of sorts, a mental one, mental machinery that can put us all together so that it'll work. So I want to have a systemic definition of wealth. Well, systemically, tradable wealth is the inputs and outputs of individual systems. It's the stuff we need as an individual system. It's our resources. Measurable wealth is the properties of the systems as a whole. That's why it's not tradable. Properties of the system as a whole. My education is non-tradable because it's a property of me as a whole. My health, here's an interesting example. My health, one of the things that I need to be healthy, a component of my system is my blood. I need my blood to be healthy. That's a part of me. It's an input. Well, in fact, actually what I should say is inputs, outputs, and components of individual systems for the tradable stuff. So I can give you my blood. But by giving you my blood, I haven't given you my health. My health is the property of me as an entire unit. The same thing for the productive capacity of a region. You know, you can take a trained worker from a region and take him to another region, but from that point of view, the trained worker is a part of a system. That might change the property of the system as a whole, the productive capacity of that area. Acknowledgeable wealth. From the systemic point of view, what is acknowledgeable wealth? It's the relationships between systems. Does this make any sense?
Yeah. Good, I'm glad.
To me, this is totally revolutionary. Because what I realized when this was given to me, it was given to me by a friend of mine who said, these are the levels of wealth. I'm like, whoa. And then I thought about it and realized the systemic stuff. Is that our monetary system is entirely about building this kind of wealth, tradable wealth. That's what it's for. It's for building tradable wealth. It works very poorly at building measurable wealth and much worse at building relationships between systems. In fact, it's illegal. I didn't actually go into more details about systems. At the acknowledgeable level, and I should do that, right? When you have, and I'll get back to the legal piece in just a sec. When you have two different systems, the relationships for them, between them, are those things that are subjective between the two. In this case, in the measurable case, when it's a property of the system as a whole, it's objective because you can measure it from the outside. You're looking from the outside in and seeing this system as a whole has this health, this capacity to run, or this many visits to the doctor. Or if you're looking at the health of a forest, it has this amount of diversity of species. It has this amount of resilience. You can measure that. When you're talking about acknowledgeable wealth, relationships between systems, you're talking about what must be subjective from one system's point of view or the other. So that's why it's not measurable. But it is acknowledgeable. You can say that there is this amount of friendship from my point of view. This is a better friend than that friend. In terms of an individual's relationship with his or her region, you can say, this city gives me wealth because it has lots of culture in it. And that's a point of view from my point of view towards another system, which is the region. Two systems that interact, and that's a statement of wealth perceived by one system and the other. The task for me is to create a economic system that builds all of these levels of wealth. But our monetary system tracks only this one. What I was going to say about illegality is think about the things that just feel really dead wrong.
I don't get the thing about the relationships between systems yet. I mean, acknowledgeable, if, for example, if you look at the examples of acknowledgeable, that includes friendship, love, beauty, civility, culture, and stuff like that.
Yeah. All of those things are one system's point of view on another system, the relationship between them. That's why they're not measurable.
Because everybody's diverse in their relationship, friendship, love. Is that right?
It's because it's subjective. But that's wealth.
Yep. Within a given system, those things exist, and they're more immaterial, but they still have an effect on the whole system. Meaning, there's whatever a local regional economy, and there's different properties, there's different types of commodities, and they're being traded, and then there's this kind of immaterial aspect of it, which is very important to the whole overall wealth or health of the system.
Absolutely.
If there is no culture, if there is no relationship, if there is no beauty or any of that, then no one has any reason to work. No one has any reason.
And that's exactly the case. And that's, to me, the point of this is to see that all wealth is acknowledgeable. That which is measurable, you can acknowledge. That which a trade is an acknowledgement of wealth. Exactly as Susan said. That trade is an accounting of an act of love between two people, or could be. It's possible. Because in the end, all of these things are mixed together. There's not a clean boundary between this point and this point. It depends on what you look as being your system. From one point of view, a human being is a component of the system. Because I am a worker in this system. And so you can look at this town and see what from me as a point of view, as a component of the system. From another point of view, I am a system as a whole. From the other point of view, I am in relation to other people. It's not unmixable. But this is a categorization.
Well, I see. It's not mutually exclusive.
No. In fact, this is containment. These are drawn this way because it's containment. Everything that is tradable is acknowledgeable. Mm-hmm. Everything that is measurable is acknowledgeable. The other way is what's not the case. Not everything that is tradable is measurable. I mean, not everything that is measurable is tradable, and not everything that is acknowledgeable is measurable.
Wouldn't you consider, I would consider health to be a tradable asset when you look at high fructose corn syrup. It's in everything. It's destroying our children. And so, people are making money on it. So wouldn't health in that way be considered tradable?
What you pointed out is the beautiful fact of the relationship between these things. A tradable part of the system can cause ill health. So the tradable part changes the property of the system as a whole. But it's tradable. At that point of view, corn syrup is a tradable part of our wealth state.
Now, but then wouldn't big business be trading on our health?
Right. Well, that's the point is that when you put that unmeasurable quality into and constrain it to a tradable context, it erodes the part of it that you can't measure.
So this is what this is saying here is beautiful. And this is my point to begin with. It's a tradable wealth. The only kind of money, the only tool that we have in our economic system is tuned to this kind of wealth, but we try to build measurable wealth. We try to build health using money. And we try even to build acknowledgeable wealth using money. And it works terribly, because these different, they're totally different systemics that are involved. So what you're saying is that the exact realization of the problem, because we are treating, we're trying to build measurable wealth in the current monetary system.
That our monetary system is about charitable wealth. But just to be clear that not all charitable wealth is monetized or ever will be. Because there's all kinds of transactions that are not monetary, like gifts.
That's absolutely right. I think the statement that you're making there is exactly key and central. And I hope it comes out as a result of the talk about how I want to see money transformed and what monetization means. When you say monetized, what you're saying is transformed into our current U.S. dollars.
No, I'm not.
Reverse
shares, it doesn't matter. Low currency, I mean, it's not going to keep people from gifting and other kinds of ways of transacting for the services.
Absolutely. Okay. I hope what I have to say will explain this. Let's see that it gets
there.
I mean, I think that's key. Please, hold on to that. I think that's absolutely central. There's this chart at the very end of this thing that speaks exactly to that. more questions about this categorization scheme of wealth?
You were going to talk about the illegality of
it. Oh, what I was just thinking about was how... what I was thinking about was prostitution, right? Prostitution is illegal because we're trying to buy love with money. In some deep way.
Not
of course that's what it is. But look what's going on. I mean, there's a deep problem in there in using and putting money into love relationships. So that's probably not the best example. But my point is that when we try to do stuff out here, we end up legislating against it, we end up doing stuff that reflects the reality that we know that this is true, because our money can't handle that. Nor should it. Because of what our money is.
But, I mean, they did handle the slave trade for years. The only reason people kind of realized that wasn't... It was profitable, it was lucrative. But it wasn't handled because it was immoral. And people finally realized that, so...
They realized that we were treating people as an input or a part of the system. That's not right.
Right, it's not right, but it was still profitable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you go back to the prostitution thing, they're producing a service. Okay? Prostitution should not be legalized, it should be decriminalized. There's a difference. If it's legalized, the government can regulate it. If it's decriminalized, it's just not a crime anymore.
Okay, so
but
this gets back to our
a service.
This gets back to our actions and questions of what are our basic fundamentals in our society. So more questions about systemic wealth?
I just have a quick question. The prostitution went through me for a loop. And I'm wondering, is inacknowledgeable, spiritual gifts, so what the priest is able, or the rabbi is able to bring, what a teacher is able to bring, what an artist is able to give, I mean, is that something you would put inacknowledgeable as something that's immaterial, but is we're trying to fix a price to?
Yeah.
None of this stuff is about fixing prices. Prices only happen down here.
But he's saying that, we're still paying the priest or the rabbi for a spiritual service.
Okay.
Which would be the acknowledgeable category, you're putting a price to it.
Okay, so that's the question. That's precisely what we're facing. What are we going to do? How are we going to build a system, an economic system, that acknowledges wealth at all of these levels and contribution of wealth at all of these levels? We know that the using money isn't going to cut it here. Or it sort of cuts it, but it's failing. Okay, I want to move on because I've got, I think, some interesting things that will add to this, if I may.
I just needed clarity.
Yeah.
From someone. But I'm walking through someone in our community that was very important to our whole land for movement and stuff. And he was a young man who moved to the city. And then when we got a little factory started, he was willing to come home for less money. Because we had spots for 14 people and over 70 people who had migrated out signed up for those jobs. So he was willing to take minimum wages to get back home because of some things that I know. Number one, he wanted his children to grow up in a better culture or atmosphere.
Yeah, measurable, acknowledgeable wealth. Yeah.
Okay, so that was... Okay, and then he wanted to be able to go hunting in the woods with his buddies. And he became really the primary motivated community going to the land trust because he was able then to take this and shape how this ownership is cared for land.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just wondering, you know, the tradable would be the work for the money, right? I'm trying to get the distinction between the measurable and the acknowledgeable.
I mean, it could be both. It could be the acknowledgeable as the friendship that he had, having his buddies in the woods. And, you know, also...
The trade was the ducks he shot.
Yeah.
The trade was the ducks he shot.
That's a tradable aspect of love.
Yeah.
But the goal is not to, the goal is not to be able to place a monetary value on everything.
No. Yeah.
That is not the goal at all.
Exactly
the goal
the
is to build wealth of all these different types.
I guess
to reinvent money... To reinvent the tools
outside
that we
of that frame, outside of that limitation of a dollar bill,
to make us be able to build these forms of wealth.
But also, I have to get a handle in, if I'm thinking in a larger, even a reason why a person for their own system of wealth would want to was raised in the country, moved to the city, but would choose to come back to the country because there's more wealth there, even though it, he measures as part of the poverty.
Right.
Now, I would call that acknowledgeable wealth. It's something that's that is the relationship between himself as a system and that area, the culture that it has, the people that he has. So that's purely acknowledgeable. There's no way of measuring that. But it's wealth. And I mean, our economic system has to handle that kind of wealth if it's going to be one that is, why I said my purposes were equitable, sustainable, and thriving.
Yeah.
It can't do that unless it acknowledges that level of wealth. But it also has to have measurable wealth. He's got to stay healthy. He can't have too high a pollution count. He also has to have tradable wealth. He's got to have the ducks and the food. All three levels. Can I move on?
One quick question. Who came up with this system? Who came up with this scheme?
The levels of wealth like this was told to me by Jean-François Nevet. And this is...
You're right.
Level of wealth. Can I clear the rest of the
Jean-François Nevet. He is a researcher in collective intelligence. If you go to thetransitioner.org, you'll see a lot of his stuff there. The stuff about understanding that these levels of wealth are about systemics, that's stuff that I figured out.
Wait, just one last thing here. I mean, I was with you, but then, you know, but so now, so what the assumption or the premise is that our economic system, our current economic system, only the monetary economic system is only operating in the realm of tradable. And not to say that our systems or our communities don't have, because you're saying the idea is to create an economic system that has all these things, but doesn't our system have it already? Like, don't we already have love and...
But not recognizable.
What I'm saying is, I want us to see this.
Not recognizable in the tradable system.
Yeah.
Recognizable in our everyday lives.
But not in the tradable system. And the key is to get these things in the tradable system.
No. The key is to create a system. I don't care what you want to call it. Throw away the word economics. The thing is, what we have right now is a system that deals in this stuff and breaks down this stuff. That's what it does. So to me, this is why I went back to axioms. What is wealth? What I want to do is build wealth. Okay, so what is wealth? Well, this is wealth. The current system, the tradable system, breaks this stuff down. It destroys the health of ecosystems by the nature of all kinds of stuff. It destroys our ability to be in community. We heard tons of examples of that people were talking about. I don't need to go there. It's an incredibly destructive system to these things. And if you go to very poor communities, you will find they have very little tradable wealth. But they actually have huge amounts of measurable wealth. And you go to rich communities, they've got all of this, and they suck up here.
Right?
So it's destructive. I'm saying that our economic system is destructive to all the levels of wealth. So what? I don't care what you want to call it. I want to create a system that we live by. A constructed system that we live by. That understands that wealth is all of these things, and builds all of these forms of wealth. Done.
There you go.
All right.
And does it
is it this new axiom that you hear now with bankers of the triple bottom line?
No, because that's monetizing it all. Yeah. And I don't think you can monetize it.
No, I don't think the triple bottom line is monetizing it. I think
that's measuring through anything. It's not monetizing.
So that's going to, I think, get you up to here, maybe, a little bit.
Don't trust the bankers.
Well, bankers can be really good guys, too.
Right.
That's a really nice guy.
You're a member of the bank.
I'm not very nice. Okay, I would like to go on. Okay, axiom number two for me. What is money? This, to me, is an axiom of the economic system. Now, most people would say, well, you guys had these other axioms out there. And like if you look at capitalism versus communism, the axiomatic difference between those two systems, or the place where they choose a different thing, is who should own what. The individual should own the means of production, or the state should, or the state as a proxy for the community should own the means of production. Those are two axiomatic differences. But they both use money, and they both relatively define wealth the same way. So to me, that's why wealth was axiom number one. Axiom number two is what money is. And this was, to me, the huge, deep revelation. It's like, holy bananas, I thought money was just something that it is. But in fact, it's also constructed. It's an invention. It's a tool. So, what is money? Let's real quickly go through some definitions of money.
Medium of exchange.
Thank you. A medium of exchange.
Account of our deeds of love, princess.
More quick.
I mean, tool to value.
An instrument?
What you buy stuff with.
I mean, yeah, deeds of love or deeds of hate, really.
So you've got it as deeds now, I can just put that. Okay.
Abstracted value?
Abstracted value.
Yes, store value.
Hey, yes.
Coins and paper.
I guess instrument does it. It's a means to bring creativity into the world, and genius into the world.
Or destruction.
Yep.
Well, you know, you gotta have both.
Okay, so wait a second. Now, are these things the functions of money or the thing that money is itself?
Money is paper.
I guess it's more the functions.
And notes. Money is notes, I guess.
Money is virtual.
An accounting system.
Money is not touch anymore.
It's something that we determine has a representation of value of all of it. Piece of paper, a gold coin,
pressing send out.
Okay.
It's the screwed up system of our economics right now.
Any other ones? Did you have one?
A unit of measure.
Unit of measure. Okay, thank you. That's a good one. Unit of measure. That's actually another one of the functions of money. Of measure. I wanted to distinguish between these two things.
You should say, I think you should perhaps say value.
Yeah.
He was actually talking about the unit of measure. We think of money as a unit of measure. We use $1 is measures of range of value.
Right.
Right. Right.
Okay, so.
So we place value on a certain amount.
Yeah. So, but these are the functions of money. What's money itself? We got more into money itself in here.
Paper and coin.
Well, that's the form of money, not money itself. I mean, because it's paper, coins, wampum, numbers in a bank account. Each one of those are different forms, but it's not money itself. Like, what is it?
Means of exchange.
Means of exchange, we got that up here. All right, I'm going to read some that the experts have said. An expert says, money is an information system we use to deploy human effort. How does that sound to you? No, think about that. It's an information system. This is actually, that's almost Susan's definition.
Yeah.
It's almost Susan's definition. Except hers is much, it's dressed up much nicer. I like the compliment. No, seriously. What did you say? An accounting of deeds of love. So accounting is an information system. Deeds of love is the deployment of human effort. At least positive human effort. Down here we talked about hate. So that's the negative human effort. Almost the same thing. Here's Bernard Leetart.
I would say more an attempt to measure human effort.
Okay.
Not necessarily successful.
That's good. Here is Bernard Leetart's definition of money. Money is an agreement within a community to use something as a means of payment.
Well, yeah, there's an agreement that people made a long time ago that
still agrees. Still be paid for the conference with money, so you still agree to use it.
Well, okay, that's assumed value, but also you don't really have a choice to necessarily say you need something to survive. It's not like I'm agreeing that this, you know, gallon of milk is worth as much as I'm paying for it, but I do need to turn over this money in order to receive.
That's a coercive marketplace. Accurate, right? There's interesting things that happen. I want to give you a different definition.
It's not necessarily a consensual agreement.
Right.
It's for writing, yes. For acknowledging.
Okay. Okay, I work for you. Okay, I perform the services, the unit of things that I do. Now, how do you weigh that in regards to money? I mean, I have to get paid for my services that I perform for you. You know, then you say, well, I'm only going to pay you this. And I know that in deep inside I'm worth more because I've done some things and what have you.
Right,
so money could be used all kind of ways just to disrupt the system.
Exactly. In other words, what you're talking about is how money does not acknowledge all the wealth that you're providing. Because you might have been providing wealth, some tradable wealth, which is creating some part of the system. You may have been creating cultural wealth for the community you lived in. You may have been particularly about, there are all kinds of, like, you could have been not providing some other kind of wealth to the community because you were working there. The way we live in our economic system does not handle all the levels of wealth, which is what you're speaking to. So I want to give you this definition of wealth. It's similar to Susan's, and it's similar to the information deployment one, and I want to try to back this up with a story now. Does that seem really weird? A writing system for acknowledging wealth. Good. That means maybe I'm onto something. If I'm onto the reason why I came up with this as a definition for money for me is this book right here, which is The Spell of the Sensuous by David Abram. And I would recommend it for a number of reasons. And what he talks about in here.
Sensuous.
Yeah, that's why I put it up there. So by the way, you don't have to take tons of notes. I meant to say this in the beginning. I can print out this whole thing.
Oh, great.
If you want later. So.
Yeah.
For anybody, and also I can email you the PowerPoint, whatever you want.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And you can
now you tell. Oh, you gotta
no, I'll turn it into PowerPoint. I'm sorry, I meant to say that. And I would encourage anybody who wants to give this presentation to do it.
Yeah.
Use all my stuff, okay?
Please.
Okay, so the thing that he talked about in here was the history of the evolution of the writing system. And when I read that, I found out I knew all this other stuff that we just talked about here. This I read about in these books that the experts gave me. This guy who's not talking about money, who's talking about writing and what writing has done to human consciousness. That's where I realized what's really going on, I think, if I'm right.
Can I back up and ask a question?
Absolutely.
When supposedly the Sumerians invented writing, right?
Okay. Well, a lot of different people did, yeah.
Well, back in, I don't know what year it was.
5,000 BC or something?
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, is the theory that before that act, or that system was brought into being, that money did not exist?
No, you'll see it. Let me give you the story. So here's the story. Okay, so I'm going to go back and I'm going to give the story that he was talking about in here. This is my own phrasing of it, and this is in progress. This is the stuff that I've done most recently here. So it could all be hogwash, but bear with me and see what you think of it. This is like, I'm not an expert. This is what I'm just messing around with. And I feel empowered to give this to you, and I empower you to tell me that it's bogus, or to take it further on your own and do whatever you want with it. So the story of writing is that to generate this is the story I'm going to tell you. So, to generate understanding, what do we do as humans? Well, we exchange concepts, right? And when we're together in real time and face to face, what we do is we call that a conversation, a speaking. That's what I'm doing with you right now. So alone, we can generate understanding too. I can by myself go out and do research, and I can experiment with the world, and I can understand things. But in community, which is what we're talking about here, in community, we generate understanding by exchanging concepts. And real time and face to face, we call that conversation, speaking. Now, to do it over distance and time, we encode concepts. And the simplest way to encode a concept is to use the shape and the form of that concept to make a drawing. Right? So if I'm going to talk about a carrot, I got to talk to you together right here as a personal thing. If I want to tell you about a carrot tomorrow, I can draw you a carrot. I can leave a record on Lascaux on the walls about a hunting event that then transforms, that conveys the understanding, the meaning of a culture over time, and the stories can come back and we can see that drawing to relive that. Or we can start writing on pieces of paper and handing it down, and Sumeria comes in. Because in Sumeria, they wanted to transport, they wanted to write down records of, what was it, economic work, and they wanted to transform that over time and space. Okay, the writing system evolves over time. First you start with a real drawing, then you get something that looks sort of like the thing that you were drawing with, and then you get something that's a pure pictogram of that. But there are problems with using shape and form in your drawing when you want to transfer that concept across space and time. Number one.
What do you mean by a real drawing? I mean, you're including perspective and all that stuff?
Okay, fine. So really, we should start here. Here's the picture we do. There's some kind of drawing, but then we simplify it to make it easier. I mean, so the main problem with trying to transmit concepts across space and time using shape is that it's really hard to encode an abstract and non-material concept of shape. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that if you're going to try to, as a community, remember this is all from the community's perspective, if you're going to try to do this for every shape and form, it's really hard to learn and to manage because you've got to come up with a shape and form for everything that's out there.
But we'd have to be an artist.
Exactly. Now, this part, and so what ends up happening is that in cultures that started doing this, a dedicated elite developed to do that function. They were the scribes. And this was the point in time when things opened up in my mind. Now, I'm going to read you the work from Spell of the Sensuous that made me go, bing! So he's talking about the development, let's see here, of the development of a phonetic script. And he says, another factor inhibiting the development of a fully phonetic script was the often elite status of the scribes. Ideographic scripts must make use of a vast number of stylized glyphs and characters, since every term in the language must, at least in principle, have its own written character. In the 1716, a dictionary of Chinese, admittedly an extreme example, used 40,000 different characters. Today, a mere 8,000 characters are in use. Complete knowledge of the pictographic system, therefore, could only be the province of a few highly trained individuals. Literacy within such cultures was, in fact, a literacy of caste or cult, and sacred knowledge was often held in great esteem by the rest of society. Huh. Doesn't that sound like the banker? It is unlikely that the scribes would be willing to develop innovations that could simplify the new technology, the technology of writing, and so render literacy more accessible to the rest of society. For this would surely lessen their own importance and status. When I read that, the scales fall from my eyes. So what's the solution? It's already been hinted here. The solution is that to solve these three problems, we have to come up with a new encoding system for transmitting concepts across space and time.
Beast by Peterson stuff. Critical rewriting of the virtual global economy.
I'm not familiar with that. So this one right here is the main one. It's the alphabet. And just as we heard before, ideograms are similar. It's a different method of doing it. And it has to be simplified down to at least 8,000 or even usually 3,000 that people can actually become literate and learn. But more interestingly to me is this one here, the alphabet. That's the thing I want to focus on. Okay, so this is the story of the evolution of writing from encoding meaning or concepts in shape and form to encoding them using a different methodology of encoding, namely an alphabet, which encodes the sound of the words, not the meaning directly itself. So, now I'm going to try to draw a parallel for you. And this is why I'm claiming that money is a form of writing. To generate wealth, we exchange valuables. Real time and face-to-face, we call it Real time and face to face, when we're exchanging data. What's it called? Barter. Thank you. Okay, and you know we haggle in conversation. I mean, we speak in conversation. We haggle for barter. Okay. So going again, but the question is, how are we going to encode value to do that over space and time? And Susan explained it. She showed us in clear form. What we do is we encode it with relative scarcity.
What?
Yeah, actually, you're right. You were explaining it.
Yeah.
Does it make any sense? No. Okay, so here's the deal. We start with, here I'll draw the evolutionary picture of it. We start with something like wheat. So, and you actually did talk about commodity money. Commodity money uses a commodity, and it uses an amount of that commodity in some degree that has a relationship of the relative scarcity between the thing that you're trying to encode the value of. So if I've got carrots, and we're going to use a brick of tea as our commodity money, we're going to use about the same amount of scarcity of my carrots and the bricks of tea for doing our exchange. So we encode the value of my carrots. The reason why they're valuable is because they're scarce. The reason why the carrots, they don't grow on trees. They grow underground, and I have to work on them. That's what makes the carrots valuable to me, because I can't get one everywhere. If I'm by a river, the water is not scarce, it's not valuable to me. But if I live someplace where I have to really hoof it, there's a small amount of it, it's scarce. That is what's going on in this form of being able to transmit wealth across time. We use the relative scarcity of something that is at about the same relative scarcity as the thing that we're trying to transmit the value of.
Are you talking about when goods are becoming money? Or are you just talking about
the relationship, the measurement component, the relationship between the community and the availability of the goods can help?
Or how it's how
it's,
goods,
it's
how
the valuation process itself, that how anything is defined must be defined in relationship to its supply, in what you're saying there. Because if air is everywhere and everyone's got it and it's easy and it's full and it's good, then no one really values it.
Well, we do. There's not enough of commoditizable. This is like how carrots acquire value.
Or it's like, okay, if I want to do a barter with you, okay, and I want to trade you my pen for your duffel bag, you're like, there's so many pens out there. My double bag is worth more than your pen because I could get, you know, there's so many more pens out there.
It's a perfect example. Yeah. Okay, so that's what you're doing is you're finding the relative difference in value between those two pieces. And what I'm saying is that initially, just like in the evolution of writing, when you start with shape and form to encode the concept that you're trying to transmit over space and time, what we do with money is that we use something of relatively similar scarcity.
Right.
We're using the fact that it's scarce. Now, all of this, I want to parenthetically point back, it's all stuck in the tradable realm, because the only things that are scarce are in the tradable realm. Right? Their value at the other level are, well, okay, so that's not fully true. There are other things that are scarce, but that really defines tradable wealth.
I wouldn't use the word scarcity. Labor, the equality is labor applied to natural resources. So, as Wendell Berry said, in Kentucky would be chickens. Because, like, everyone has, chickens are abundant, but everyone has a sense of what it would take to raise chickens. So they can say, yeah, give you 7 chickens for that.
It sounds like a labor.
And in part, it's labor applied to resources.
Okay, so that's a really good point. So maybe what I should do is change this word to scarcity and effort.
Well,
because that's about you're talking about the effort that it took. So you can start to use something that has a certain amount of effort that we all know what it is. But that also has to do with its scarcity, how hard it is to have.
I'd like to take scarcity
out. Make an availability.
Okay, I'll tell you.
Well, yeah, no, but
in the model you're using about the chickens, okay, so if because just because they have a lot of chickens there, is that what's definitive, or is it just that they know what it takes to raise a chicken?
It's so cultural. Like, here we actually looked at cordwood as the standard, because if you don't burn cordwood, your aunt does, and you have a sense of what the weight of it is, what it took to chop it up. So, and the very choice of cordwood was because it was abundant. I mean, the very reason for choosing cordwood is because access to the raw materials is abundant rather than scarce.
So the value is understood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Experience. So what I'm trying to get here, though, is what we use to encode. So I think Susan is right. Scarcity is the wrong word. Maybe the better word is relative availability.
Utility.
Well, that also makes a difference.
You're trying to equate apples and oranges.
Yeah.
Like you're trying to say, how many oranges does it take to get your apple? And it's like, how do you? What's the common denominator that you're using to equalize three of my apples equals one of your oranges, or vice versa?
Right. Which is what I think is considered. That's how we do it over distance and time. We encode, and that's what we have to encode. Equal, right?
So the question is, what are we using as an encoding system? I was claiming here that the thing that we encode is relative scarcity. We're hearing other things that we encode, relative availability.
Well, the word relative is the key word. It means
relative to
the thing that we know well, which is that's cordwood. So we don't have any carrots, but we have all this cordwood. How many of these carrots that are really hard? So I think effort is the key.
Yeah, it depends on
relativity.
How much effort does it take to eat carrots, so it equals the amount of cordwood that isn't as much effort?
But you can use a lot of different measures. Like you could use, how much trouble was it? How much resources did it require? But it's the relativity that, it's however you work out that relativity. But
signifiers by themselves are relative, because we only know what scarcity is in relation to abundance.
Yeah.
So if we're going to use this language money metaphor, right, then in a sense what we're dealing with here is the relationality that allows us to know which signs we're dealing with, scarcity or abundance.
That makes sense to me. I heard that.
I mean, this all relates to,
But I think it also goes back to relativity, you know, what's relative to me and relative to the guy two counties over,
it's
going to be different. It's like when I was at powwows, you trade with the vendors for what you need, you know, and this year a goatskin might cost me three pair of earrings, and next year because they didn't get a chance to go out and hunt,
or there was a drought or something,
so next year a doe skin is going to cost me five pair of earrings.
But that's price. I mean, price is different from the measuring stick.
Right, and so I'm not talking about the measuring stick, which measuring stick it is. What I'm talking about here, or what I'm trying to get across, is this concept that what we're doing is we're using something to encode value, the value over time. Harry, you've got something to say.
Okay, we have a system that, I don't know if y'all know the word lanyap that's used down south. And how it all goes to lanyap. It's called it's more than what you're supposed to get. Because when the French had taken over Louisiana, it was a measure of moving things around, goods and bartering. And what they would do, they would put the sugar or the flour in a sack, and they would measure it, and they would pour it out to the amount that you had required. But there was always some particles still left within the threads. See, when they pour it into your particular sack, you know, and at least they'll give you the sack, you know, what have you, you would still have a little bit left up in there. And that was called the lanyap, and you would always get that. Because you may have asked for a pound, but you may come out with 1 pound plus 3, 4, 5 ounces over a period of time. That was a measurement, because there was no money being exchanged, because you know, after being under the French and English and British and everybody else, you know, it was hard for currency to go back and forth. So, and there was no way of encoding this particular practice and what have you, but everybody except the method of trade, the way things was going on based upon what you were saying in regards to the dose of the earrings. So it's kind of hard. It's easier now because we have ways of doing things now, but early on, I think in different culture and different situations, you had a different way of measuring, you know, goods and services, especially. That's why the word lanyard comes about, because if I come and order a plate of food from you, you say, I'll add this on to it, you know, and we call that lanyard because you get a little extra.
Like a baker's dozen.
Huh?
Like a baker's dozen.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's always a little extra coming up. Yeah, let me thank the French for that. So.
Well, Susan,
right.
I just love the word scarcity out of doing the thing. You know, all together. I just like to, like,
well, is availability, and acceptable. I mean, it's not the concept, it's the word, it's relative availability.
Why not scarcity? Because of the connotation?
Well, can I make a distinction? The distinction is, I mean, we're trying to envision a new paradigm of money.
Yeah.
The old paradigm of money is based on its scarcity. Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Eric is taking the word money and putting it into a new paradigm.
Because what we're trying to do here is get away from
the point in which we're reacting to the word money. Because as long as we're reacting to the word money, we're reacting to everything that comes along in within money. And when we're reacting to what's in money, we're preventing ourselves from inventing the new society.
So thank you. I should have said that one.
Okay.
So, well, in fact, actually what I'm showing here is that this part right here happened thousands of years ago for our writing system. But this is not the same time period. This is now. We haven't gone to this other side, because this that was true way before, when we only had pictographic forms of writing, which you can't handle abstract concepts, well, that's exactly what's going on here. It's very hard to encode non-tradable wealth with scarcity. And that's actually what we do.
Right.
Because we're using scarcity or relative availability as our encoding method for transmitting this stuff across space and time. And the same thing that happened with writing is that we have because it's very hard to manage the scarcity of information tokens, we have a dedicated elite to do it for us. Mm-hmm. And that's the financial system. I don't want to put the nuts on the banker. The banker is a person in that. But the whole system as a whole is an elite that is actually a sacred elite in the same way that the scribes were sacred, because they produce a vital, vital function for our society. However, their problems, the same problems exist. You can't encode non-tradable wealth by using as your encoding mechanism relative scarcity availability. It doesn't work. If we want to have an economic system that's thrivable, blah, 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 we have to use a different encoding system. So the question is, what's the new encoding system?
Right. Okay.
Well, before I go on to the new encoding system, I want to talk about universal literacy a second. What giving ourselves a simplified encoding system for writing gave the world is the possibility that everybody could learn it, just like it was written there. 26 letters, not hard to learn. Everybody can do it. So for concepts, what universal literacy means is that everybody can read and write. For wealth, universal literacy means that every community can create currencies.
Huh. But I feel like that analogy doesn't really hold, because it's not like every local region creates their own language.
No, but every local region, it's not about creating language, because language
we
already have.
You're saying creating currencies, which is
talking about the alphabet.
Right, but I'm
No. Remember my definition? My definition was to be a currency was that money is the writing of wealth acknowledgments. So right now, we're in the state. Okay, here. Here is a story that I think will explain what you just said. When I was growing up in Ecuador, I'd go into the marketplace, and I would see a man sitting at a table, and there would be usually a woman next to him, and the man would be writing a list. and the woman would be sitting there waiting. I'm like, Mom, what is that man selling? Because obviously there was money on the table. What is being sold? And I'm like, is he writing a poem for her, or what's going on? I thought it was a creative endeavor or something. No, my mom said, he's writing a letter for her. She can't read and write. Okay, so that, what that story for me is this is the situation we're in. All of us right now are sitting at the table, all of our communities, because it's not a question of individuals. We're sitting at a table and we're allowing another person who knows how to read and write do our writing for us in the wealth arena. That's the situation we're in. Now, the thing I want to say about universal literacy as a step to the next phase is that universal literacy is a precondition for democracy. You cannot have democracy without literacy. And what I want to say is, what in the world is universal wealth literacy a precondition for?
Justice.
Also democracy.
Equality.
Economic democracy.
Okay, absolutely. I would say that. But my guess is that when people first invented reading and writing, they had no clue that there was such a thing as democracy. And that there is a whole new realm of reality that will come out because we do this, that we don't know what it is. Economic democracy, okay, that sounds fine. We sort of know what that is. But I'm saying that there's something much, much bigger there. And that, for me, is part of the new possibility.
There were democracies before the word was even invented. It was creating societies in which everyone had an equal part and everyone had an equal say. Without writing, without reading, and without calling it democracy.
So maybe it's true democracy, because I think the truth is we don't have true democracy.
No.
Because, yeah, so maybe the answer is true democracy. But I think actually it's even more than that. One thing about literacy, this word literacy, people use it in two ways. They use literacy to mean having an acquaintance with a subject matter. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about wealth literacy and that I know about banks and stuff like that. I'm talking about being able to write wealth acknowledgments. The bookkeeping meeting, that's exactly what Susan said. Making accounting of our acts of love and actually taking on that responsibility and being capable of doing that as a community. That, to me, is what is going on here. So, we had two sets of questions. For me, what comes next is action. What am I going to do about this? This is what gets to your question. I mean, this is all way out here ideas. But I'm not about, well, I am about ideas. I love them, you can tell, right? This is great. But to me, what's necessary, what comes next, is to create a wealth alphabet. To create the thing that's the exact same equivalence of the alphabet. To create something that all of us can use to learn and write.
You have been listening to Speaker Eric Harris Brown's remarks at the E.F. Schumacher Society Training Seminar, Building Sustainable Local Economies, held on May 21st to the 25th of 2008. The E.F. Schumacher Society is a membership-supported organization. For more information on the E.F. Schumacher Society, visit www.smallisbeautiful.org, call 413-528-1737, or write to 140 Jug End Road, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, 01230.